Hello, it's April 3rd, 2025. My name is Simone, and this is 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. Like always, I hope you all have had a great week so far and are preparing for a great weekend. And with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1990, the year I was born. And in the vibrant city of Portland, Oregon, many people here loved their city for many different reasons. For one, many Portland residents loved the climate in the city, as the city was known for its mild, wet winters, warm, dry summers, and extreme rainfall. But that was okay, because the rain contributed to Portland's vibrant greenery that gave the city the nickname Rose City, due to the parks and gardens housed in the city, including their famed Forest Park, Japanese Garden, and the Grotto. Also, Portland was known at this time for its notable coffee shops and independent bookstores, and its thriving arts scene, including theater, visual arts, and music. Speaking of music, Portland's music scene was becoming more diverse as well. Genres like grunge, punk rock, alternative rock, and even jazz became a pivotal part of Portland's music scene, as well as their legendary music venues at the time, which included La Luna, The Pines, and Starry Night. Speaking of Starry Night, this certain smaller venue was one of the more popular ones in town that had hosted acts like Tina Turner and Motley Crue. And reports state the venue boomed in business throughout 1990. However, in the same year, a report would come in about shady activity happening at Starry Night. And when the heat became too much for the powers that be at the club, a grisly murder would occur. In the following case, you'll find out about the victim, the investigation, and the aftermath in a case I title Backstage Secrets. Although today's case takes place in Portland, Oregon, let's begin 2,500 miles away in New Orleans, Louisiana. Reports state that here in January 1990, local couple Mike and Penny Moreau were not at ease. You see, on January 19th, their son, 21-year-old Timothy Tim Moreau, called them from his home in Portland, Oregon, to vent about his boss, Larry Hurwitz, who owned the local Starry Night venue in Portland. Tim told his parents that he thought he worked his butt off to please Larry as a promoter at the venue, but felt he was not earning enough money and had not received a raise. Tim was said to be so upset at Larry that he also told his parents that he had some dirt on Larry and said he was going to the police about it. And then, after he told them this, he asked if he could move back home to which his parents agreed. 2 days later, on the 21st, Tim called his parents again and told them he was nervous about his quote-unquote situation at work, and said he would be meeting with Larry that day, but that everything was under control and he could take care of himself. Days went by after Tim's last phone call with his parents, and Mike and Penny worried about what Tim meant about his situation at work. But they grew even more worried when more time passed and they hadn't heard back from him. Even worse, on January 24th, the Moreaus received a call from Tim's landlady, and she asked them if they had seen or heard from him, since she hadn't for a while. Now, the Moreaus were in panic mode, but they had to keep as calm as possible to try and find their son. They repeatedly tried to call Tim at his home, but they only got an answering machine. They then called to speak with Larry Hurwitz at the Starry Night, but again, they got an answering machine from the business as well. However, reports state Larry called the Moreaus back several days later on February 1st and told Mike he hadn't seen Tim ever since he came to him days earlier and told him about his part in a shady ticket scam and that he thought Tim fled to avoid justice. However, Penny and Mike knew that that didn't sound like Tim, even if he was aware or a part of a ticket selling scam. He wouldn't just go off without telling them. So reports state, the next day, the Moreaus called Portland police to report Tim missing and told them the last time they had heard from him. Portland police were said to have gotten to work to find Tim right away. And curiously, reports state that later that day, police received word about an abandoned car seen at the airport. And after running the plates, they learned that the car was Tim's. However, police discovered Tim had not been scheduled for any flight, and there were still no signs from him at the airport or anywhere else in town. By now, the Moreaus were really on edge about their son. And on February 3rd, 1990, they finally traveled to Portland to try and find Tim. But reports state, when the Moreaus got to Tim's apartment, they still found no trace of him. According to reports, Timothy Tim Douglas Moreau was born in May 1968 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to social workers Mike and Penny. And according to them, they were surprised that their firstborn child was born with bright red-orange hair while they were brunettes. The Moreaus moved to New Orleans when Tim was one, and a year after the move, they welcomed another son, Charles. Tim was said to be an outgoing and friendly child growing up, and some of his favorite interests included bowling, Boy Scout meets, where he eventually became a senior member, and music, which became a crucial part of his life. Reports state Tim started playing violin in the fourth grade, and from the moment he touched the instrument, he was hooked. Tim was said to have played his violin constantly as a child, and it was also said that he'd go door to door in his neighborhood to play his violin at Christmas. As he attended school, Tim was an honor student and gifted in academics and the arts, even graduating in the top 10% of his class when he graduated in 1986. His grades were so great that he was offered a full-ride scholarship to Louisiana State University and 4 other colleges. But by this time, Tim decided to explore a more quote-unquote liberal atmosphere and decided to study at Reed College in Portland. And he also liked that Reed was situated in the beautiful Northwest. Tim majored in philosophy while attending Reed, kept up a 3.6 GPA, and worked for the college's radio station. But reports state that after a while at Reed, Tim became disillusioned with the school and its too many quote-unquote hippies. So he decided to take an approved leave of absence from the school and decided to have a more hands-on approach in the music industry. Reports state Tim used his contacts from the radio station in the music business, and through one of these contacts, he got a position at the Starry Night music venue in March 1989, where he helped in promotion and publicity. According to reports, the Starry Night venue began as a church called Apostolic Faith Church back in 1922, with it operating all the way until 1981, when the owners sold the property to the city. Then, in 1982, a 27-year-old Larry Hurwitz, a transplant from New York, borrowed money from his father to buy and convert the property to the Starry Night. According to reports, Larry was born and raised in New York City, but due to a shaky relationship with his family, reports state Larry ran away from home when he was 14. He then lived on and off the streets and worked jobs around town to make money, but he always loved the jobs that were surrounded by music. Reports state that when he was 16, Larry got a job working as security at a rock music hall. Then, in 1974, he got a job working security at a music venue. However, by 1975, he was still down on his luck, and he decided to leave New York and lived with his grandfather on his farm in Washington State, where he also worked a little while. After his stay with his grandfather, Larry moved to La Center, Washington, and lived on a commune. After the commune collapsed, Larry made his way to Portland and worked in several restaurants before opening his own natural food restaurant in the Old Town neighborhood. However, Larry wanted to go back into the music business, and after he persuaded his father to let him borrow the money, he opened Starry Night. According to reports, after Starry Night opened, business started off a little slow. But after a while, and with some help from his friends to help market the business, Starry Night became the go-to to see live bands. One report from 1987 said of Starry Night and Larry, quote-unquote, "Some nights is a rock club. Other nights it's a blues club, or maybe comedy, jazz, country, new wave, oldies, or gospel. It's been a little bit of everything except classical." Over time, Starry Night began to host acts that included anyone from B.B. King, Tina Turner, Chuck Berry, Twisted Sister, and more. And when Starry Night hosted Chuck Berry, Larry said sarcastically to the local paper, quote unquote, "With Chuck Berry, half the crowd was people I've never seen in the downtown clubs, all in their upper 30s. I figure the babysitters made a killing that night." Larry had the Portland music venue scene at the palm of his hands. However, reports state, behind the scenes at Starry Night, Larry wasn't as loved by quite a few people as he was to the public. You see, when Larry borrowed money from his father to open Starry Night, he actually went into business with his brother David as well at the venue. But eventually, Larry told David he would buy out his interest so he could be the sole proprietor of the venue. But in 1987, after he failed to pay, David sued Larry. But in 1988, the suit was dismissed. Larry also left a bad taste in the mouths of many officials around Portland, as he was known to operate Starry Night with liquor flowing, even when he had expired liquor licenses time to time. And some officials knew about Larry's shadiness due to his numerous tax evasion and driving incidents. Larry was also known to badmouth other venues if he felt they were competition. And sometimes the badmouthing would be so bad that he would get venues fined for things like overcrowding. At Starry Night itself, though, Larry was said to be one of the toughest bosses around, and he could be feared and very influential, almost like a bully. For example, reports state that back in 1983, after Larry learned that an employee stole $5,000 in cash, along with rumored cocaine and pornography from Starry Night, Larry sought revenge by not pressing charges, but with intimidation. Reports state Larry decided to kidnap the employee's parents and hold them for ransom until he got back what he thought was stolen. He was also able to convince several of his employees to trick the employee's parents into flying to Portland from Texas, somehow. But word got back to police about this plan, and it was intercepted at the last minute at the airport by the Port of Portland police. And although a report on the incident was filed, no charges were ever filed. Also at the Starry Night, what many didn't know outside of the venue was that Larry was involved in another shady business that operated at Starry Night that most didn't know about, until news broke about it in 1990. You see, Starry Night had planned to host the famed blues singer John Lee Hooker for a show on January 20th, 1990. But a few days earlier, promoters who booked John Lee Hooker into Starry Night were listening to a local radio station when the DJ said there were still tickets for sale at another local venue named Day for Night, which wasn't supposed to be selling tickets. To investigate, the promoters unexpectedly showed up at Starry Night on the night of the show and said they'd take the tickets at the door. When Larry recognized the promoters, he knew something was up. And even worse, he knew the secret behind those extra tickets. They were fake. Reports state that for several years at Starry Night, Larry was involved in a counterfeit scheme at the venue where he would make fake tickets and sell them so he could make more profit than the promoters. Except now, he was caught and panicked. According to reports, though, he wasn't going to take the fall for this. Instead, he told the promoters that the fake tickets more than likely came from his latest hire, Tim Moreau. Reports state that after Larry named Tim as the forfeiter, he immediately went to Tim and asked him to take the fall, in which Tim refused. Yes, he had counterfeited some tickets of Starry Night, but it wasn't just one time. It was almost as soon as he started working there that Larry and his staff had him do the dirty work. And so did other staff as well. And he wasn't going down for what he and others at Starry Night did. You see, according to reports, shortly after Tim started working at Starry Night, Larry introduced him to one of his seasoned staff members named Kathy Cat Hand. And she taught him everything shady Larry wanted him to do. Kat was hired at Starry Night initially to work the front door, and she was taught by Larry to cheat customers out of money by shortchanging them on their cash ticket purchases. For example, if customers gave her a 50, she'd give them change for a 20 and pocket the rest. She'd also cheat promoters out of their fair share of the door by undercounting the customers. Lastly, Kat's other job was to produce counterfeit tickets for Starry Night shows booked by outside promoters, with Larry pocketing all the proceeds instead of splitting it with the promoters, which he was required to do so with real tickets. Reports state Larry paid her pennies for her work, but he did let her live underneath Starry Night in a shabby room with no windows. However, by the time Tim started working there, Kat was living with an extreme drug addiction and decided to get help, so she decided to go to inpatient treatment, and then Tim took her place. Fast forwarding to when the ticket scheme was caught, Tim was angered that Larry wanted him to take the fall. And also by this point, Tim was upset that Larry wasn't paying him what he felt he was earned, and wanted to confront him about it. But then Tim disappeared. According to reports, after Larry talked to Tim's parents on the phone, they told a detective in Tim's case about what Larry told them. The detective told them not to visit Larry in person, but detectives did. Reports state that sometime in early February 1990, detectives asked Larry if he had anything to do with Tim's disappearance, and he told them no and mentioned Tim's involvement with the ticket scam. But when detectives eventually asked Larry to take a lie detector test, he stalled for a few days, went to Los Angeles, and then came back to take it, and passed with flying colors. During the investigation, word started to spread around Portland about Tim's disappearance, and according to reports, it eventually made it to the press and local papers. And they not only talked about the disappearance, but the alleged scam as well, with one publication becoming a very popular read throughout the city about the case. By late March 1990, Tim's parents flew back to Portland to take Tim's belongings and ship them home to Louisiana. However, against the detective's wishes from earlier, they visited Larry and confronted him. According to reports, Mike and Penny grilled Larry about whether or not he knew anything about what happened to Tim, and he overall said no. But when reports state Mike questioned Larry if Tim left the office alone the last night he saw him, Larry was said to have paused a full 30 seconds before saying yes, in which Mike found strange. So strange that on March 29th, Mike spoke to a local reporter who wrote the popular local article about Tim's disappearance and told him about his strange encounter with Larry, who by 1991 sold the Starry Night. The reporter from the paper continued to add more and more to the article about Tim's disappearance. And in the same month, the publication announced that the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office presented information on Tim's disappearance to a grand jury, with the publication distributing their own material to them as well. But reports state the grand jury declined to indict anyone without a body. Fast forwarding to May 1991, no real developments were accumulating regarding Tim's disappearance. But by this time, Larry and his friend, Harvey Freeman, sued the publication, the journalist, and a witness for libel and invasion of privacy. 2 months later, the defendants countersued the two men, all while Tim was still missing. According to reports, by the next year, in June 1992, the judge in the publication suit granted the publication's motion for summary judgment against all claims. And curiously, reports state that in July 1992, detectives received an anonymous tip telling them to search the Willamette River under the steel bridge for Tim's body. But it was not found. But who was noticed by a detective there at the scene was Larry and Harvey watching the search unfold nearby, with one detective claiming they heard Larry say, quote unquote, "They'll never find anything." The next day, though, on July 24th, 1992, detectives served a search warrant on the former Starry Night, now named Roseland Theater, and seized carpet from Larry's former office. Reports state that as the investigation into Tim's disappearance went on for years, Larry continued to participate in shady dealings and get-rich-quick schemes. He even moved to and from the United States and even got back in the music industry a bit years later, including promoting, and it was said he was making decent money. However, by February 1997, back in the States, Larry was indicted on 4 counts of federal income tax evasion, accused of hiding more than $420,000 in income from 1987 to 1990. But by this point, Larry was living in Vietnam, working as a promoter, and even though there was a warrant for his arrest, Larry refused to return from Vietnam. And in return, by December 1997, the U.S. State Department pulled Larry's passport, and he was arrested and deported for being an undocumented alien. When he arrived back in the States, Larry was denied bail. But a month later, in January 1998, a judge released Larry to a halfway house. But reports state Larry was not required to post bail at the time of his release, nor did he have a job. Fast forwarding to April 1998, Larry pled guilty to 1 count of tax evasion and awaited sentencing, which was for July 1998. But little did he know was that outside of his current legal issues, detectives back in Portland were still working and looking at him in regards to Tim Moreau's disappearance. And as luck would have it, reports state that in May 1998, a male and female confidential informant went to detectives in Tim's case and told them they knew someone who knew lots of information about the case. And her name was Kat Hand. Reports state that the female informant said she and Kat were patients together in a drug rehab program, and that Kat told her some details of the disappearance, and that Tim was more than likely dead, having been murdered. The male also said the same thing because he too was a patient at the same time. With this info, detectives tracked down Kat and asked her about what she knew about the claims. And she denied the allegations from the informants, but she did give insight about the counterfeit ticket scam, and she later passed a lie detector test. However, Kat then asked one of the detectives for a favor. Reports state that years before, after the news broke about Tim's disappearance, Kat felt guilty and thought she knew who might have been involved, and that was Larry, Harvey, and Larry's former worker, George Castagnola. She also said that in response, she wrote a letter of regret to Tim's parents for anything she had done that may have contributed to his death. She never sent the letter because she did not have their address, but she asked the detectives to give it to them, and they did. The Moreaus responded to Kat, and they eventually all met at a hotel, despite the detectives' knowledge, and Kat told them she would find out herself what happened to Tim. Meanwhile, Larry, in July 1998, was sentenced to 12 months and 3 years supervised parole for his tax evasion charges. While Kat, in August, drove to Orcas Island, Washington, where she tracked down Harvey Freeman, who worked at a motel. They made small talk, and then Kat meticulously questioned him about what he knew about Tim's disappearance. Reports state that over the next 2 days, Harvey said Larry said he was going to kill Tim because he wouldn't take responsibility for the counterfeit ticket scam, and that Larry and George borrowed his Cadillac twice, once to dig a grave in a gorge, the second time to bury his body. And it's unclear if Tim's parents were told this information around that time, but reports state that on August 6th, 1998, Penny and Mike had Tim declared legally dead. On August 14th, Kat went to detectives and told them about what Larry said. And then on the 18th, with the direction of detectives, Kat recorded a 20-minute phone call between she and Harvey, and he confirmed everything he told her days earlier. On the 19th, detectives planned to confront Harvey at the motel, but he had instinctively fled, and then detectives filed an arrest warrant for him, with a U.S. attorney filing a federal one against him as well for being a material witness. Curiously, the same day, Larry was arrested for violating the terms of his pre-sentence release, because reports state federal law enforcement officials had been unable to reach him for several days. And on the 20th, Larry was given an ankle monitor until he was to report to jail. 6 days later, Harvey Freeman contacted detectives from Thailand and said he was ready to talk. The next day, he was arrested in Thailand by immigration officials working with customs officials. And after this, it's unclear how he found out, but Larry contacted Harvey and asked Larry what he was going to say if contacted by the police. In which Harvey said, quote unquote, "Everything I know." On the 28th, Larry decided to report to prison 2 weeks early. But before he did, he apparently contacted George and told him Harvey may be ready to talk to detectives. In early September, detectives traveled to Thailand to meet Harvey and accompany him back to Portland. When they arrived back, Harvey talked about what he knew regarding Tim's disappearance and was granted immunity in exchange for his cooperation. Days later, Harvey signed a plea bargain agreement and testified before a grand jury, and then returned to Thailand. On September 29th, police began surveillance on George's home for the next several days. On October 5th, detectives obtained tapes of 9 phone calls placed by Larry from federal prison between September 10th and 23rd. And after a lengthy, almost year-long investigation, police officially name George Castagnola and Larry Hurwitz as suspects in Tim's disappearance. Reports state he gave a detailed statement to police about helping Larry make Tim disappear and confirmed Tim was dead. George told them that on January 21st, 1990, Larry set up a meeting between him, George, and Larry's former girlfriend, Beatrice Walbum, and plotted to kill Tim. George suggested they choke him and also said they should dig a grave in advance. He said Larry then borrowed Harvey's car, and both he and Larry drove up to a gorge, crossed over to the Washington state side, and dug a grave for burying Tim's body. Hours later, after digging the grave, though, George told police that as he and Larry were leaving, they were pulled over by police, and George actually told them they had just got done digging a grave. But apparently, police brushed this off, and George was instead arrested for criminal non-payment of child support, and Larry bailed him out a short time later. George continued and said later that day, he and Larry returned to Starry Night, and he made a garrote for strangling Tim and showed Larry how to use it. On January 23rd, George said Larry lured Tim over to talk about the ticket scam, but instead he strangled him with the garrote, which broke after Tim passed out. And then George wrapped his head in duct tape to suffocate him until he died. They then took Tim's body in the car and buried Tim in the grave. Larry then went back to Starry Night and called Tim's apartment several times, leaving messages on his answering machine, as though he was still alive. George ended by saying that on January 24th, he drove Tim's car to the airport to try and make it seem like he fled. And after his confession, George was arrested for murder. On October 30th, 1998, detectives took him to the gorge area to try and find Tim's remains, but they didn't find him. They tried again on November 5th, and still no sign of Tim. While George was in jail, though, detectives tracked down Beatrice, and after offering her an immunity deal, she testified before a grand jury about what she knew as well. And by November 20th, 1998, George pled guilty to one count of murder, and then promptly sentenced to 10 years in prison. That same day, Larry was indicted on 5 counts of aggravated murder. On November 25th, Larry pled not guilty at his arraignment. However, on September 25th, 2000, Larry was sentenced to 12 years in prison, minus 1 year already served while awaiting trial, and the 1 year he already served on federal income tax evasion charges, plus lifetime post-prison supervision. However, he disputed the verdict and blamed everything on George. Larry Hurwitz was released from prison in Oregon in 2008, but reports state he was repeatedly caught traveling out of state without permission. By 2019, he was caught in California, which he was forbidden to visit, and was arrested there for possession of 4.4 pounds of cocaine and approximately $328,000 in drug proceeds. He pled guilty to those charges in 2021 and was sentenced to 8 years in prison. He was released early, however, due to the COVID-19 outbreak, and returned to custody in Oregon on January 12, 2023, where he was eventually sentenced to serve 6 months for probation violation. At his sentencing for his probation violation, Tim's parents, Mike and Penny, were there to witness it. And they told reporters, quote-unquote, 33 years ago, our lives were terribly changed. Our hopes and dreams for our firstborn son, Tim, were totally destroyed. And for what reason? The greed of one man. Both of us have had serious physical and mental health problems over these years. We still miss our son, a bright, upbeat, adventurous redhead who loved music and the outdoors. He was only 21 years old. What contributions might he have made to society? As of 2025, Tim Moreau's body has never been found. The story of the disappearance of Tim Moreau comes from the sources of KOIN-TV, the Portland Tribune, the Oregonian, and others I'll put in the notes. All right. I know that one was a lengthy one. I did a lengthier episode because I missed a few episodes in the past, as you all can tell. I'm sorry for being late. It will not happen again. I hope. I can't promise anything, but I hope it will not happen again. I'll say that. Personal life got in the way. Some things happened, but here I am with a new episode. Again, sorry it was lengthy, but the Tim Moreau case has been a case I was trying to cover for a while, but I kept reading more and more things about his case and Larry and George and things, and there was so much, because if I had done as much information I found about this case, it would be several episodes or a very, like, hours long episode, but it was just so much to this case, and I finally brought it to you and brought the most condensed part I could give you all. If you have not heard the case of Tim Moreau, it's very sad, and it's very sad that his body's never been found. And, you know, I wonder if his body was really where they said he was buried, George and Larry. Well, Larry never said it, but George said he was found and he was buried in a specific spot. But I never know. You know, he could be lying. He could have been lying. I'm not, you know, who knows? You know, I know over time, 30 plus years, you know, that was when I was born, like I mentioned, and things could have been changed with nature, if you get what I'm saying. And, you know, he could have been buried in a certain place and George could have forgot where he was buried and things like that. I don't know, but I've always wondered, I have wondered, was Tim actually buried where George said he was? Also, like, I'm not going to do a long opinion piece. I just think it's all very sad. Tim deserved better. Tim maybe should not have been doing the counterfeit scheme thing along with Larry, but he wanted a job in the music industry, got a job quickly, and probably just wanted to please his boss until he got too fed up with the whole situation. He felt he wasn't paid what he was earned, and now he wanted him to take the fall for the scheme that he wanted me to do alone. No, not at all. And things went left. Tim lost his life. Although it's never been confirmed by Larry, but there's too much overwhelming evidence that, you know, Tim was unfortunately murdered and Larry was the mastermind because he did not want to take the fall for the counterfeit scheme, even though he was the mastermind of the counterfeit scheme and Tim's murder. And it's just really sad. And I'm glad that Kat came forward and, you know, told detectives who she thought was involved, and she was right. She was right, and if it was not for Kat, I do believe Tim's case could be, had been a longer cold case than it was. It took too long to get justice, but I think it could have been longer than what it was had Kat not come forward, or even the informants came forward, because who knows if Kat would have come forward about what she knew if the informants who she served, who she was a patient with in the drug program, didn't come forward. I don't know, but I can say Kat was a big help with cracking the case of Tim Moreau's murder. But it is said that Tim's body, his remains, have never been found. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in to this brand new episode of 90s Crime Time, and I hope you found it interesting. If you liked what you heard and haven't done so, please leave a rating and review if your podcast platform has this option. Stay safe and healthy, look out for all new things 90s Crime Time, and I will see you soon for a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. Thank you.